Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 28, 2004. Today's session number is DYL-2004-08. Today's speaker is Laurel Dykstra. The lesson for today is Jubilee and Justice, Prostitution and Slavery Today. Set the Captives Free. Let's listen in.
Hi there, my name is Laurel Dykstra. Welcome to the third session on Jubilee. This particular session is on the proclaiming release to the captives, the issue of slavery and prostitution and slavery in the modern world, and also sort of in the Bible. Okay, no, sort of, also in the Bible. And most of what we're doing today that's not in the Bible comes out of this book by Kevin Bales. It's called The Disposable People, New Slavery in the Global Economy. It was available in the bookstore until selling out just recently. So it's not available here. He's got a new edition coming out, so I strongly suggest waiting until the new edition comes out. I believe it's in fact a new edition rather than a revised edition, which means that more than 25% of the information is new or changed. So it's worth getting the new one if you're going to get one.
Who's the author?
Kevin Bales. B-A-L-E-S.
B-A-L-E-S.
And it's called Disposable People. It's out copyright 1999, and it's University of California Press, Berkeley, UC Berkeley. So, with that information, it should be pretty easy to find. So, this is my second week at Holden Village. I'm here helping to animate the big Jubilee festivities that are happening on Thursday. And so I review, or sort of regard everybody who comes to one of my classes as recruits for the Jubilee pageant. So we're going to practice a little bit of some of the stuff that we're going to do tomorrow in the pageant. Tonight. Maybe not as part of our opener, but maybe as our closer. Which is the way to go. Let's just go around the room. Each person say their name and say one thing on about slavery, and that can be past or present or sort of anything else that you know. So my name is Laurel Dykstra, and I have found this book by Kevin Bales to be a very excellent resource on the subject of slavery.
I think it's Julie Craig.
And Carolyn Schur. I remember working with some part of the black community in Phoenix, Arizona in the 70s, and being so surprised when they worked to convince me that there was still slavery among them.
Jerry Strassheim. Of course, I think of slavery institutionally, systematic kind of slavery in our culture also, and how we get enslaved to stereotypes, and you know, even we can get enslaved to our own failures and lack of self-understanding and so forth. So it's a broad, I think it's very holistic.
And I'm
Connie
Strassheim, and I can remember we moved to Atlanta, Georgia from Ohio in 1963, 1964. And I had little babies, and the congregation there just all had, they called them maids, and I was not used to that at all. But they just said I had to have someone come and help me. And when I invited her to have lunch with us, she said, "No, I cannot eat with you."
My name is Betsy, and I, in the past few years, have had my eyes opened through some movies and reading about the sex slave trade in the current world, and I was really kind of shocked and surprised about it, so I've been just kind of learning and trying to trying to help educate that it's happening.
Anybody up here? I'm Shirley Powers, and when I just think pain.
Oh, I'm online. I think the issues of slavery and prostitution are much more complex than what we often might think. When you think of slavery, you think of the slave trade in the United States, bringing over black Africans to work in cotton and whatnot. And back in those days, even back in biblical times, it was a much simpler concept. There were people who were free, and then there were people who were enslaved, and you fought a war with somebody, and you beat the other country while you took their men and women as slaves to work in your household and things. We no longer have that so much, but we have many other kinds of slavery. If slavery is the opposite of freedom, then there are a lot of freedoms that you don't have. You buy a house, you have to mortgage the house. You are basically a slave to the bank. If you don't pay the mortgage, they take your house away from you. You buy a house in Portland, Oregon, and the city comes and says, you've got to plant certain trees in your backyard. You've got to plant this many trees, you've got to plant this kind of tree, you've got to put them there. So that's a lack of freedom that we have in our society. We don't often consider it slavery, but still it's an inhibition of our freedoms to do what we want. And basically, I think slavery is the ultimate inhibition of freedoms of a person to do what he wants, to live how he wants, to eat what he wants, and things. And we have certain kinds of similar things in this, in our society, with everybody. And so slavery, I think, is a complicated issue that is probably not have simple solutions. And the same thing with prostitution. I don't think you can eliminate either one. Our worldwide society, you can minimize them, but I think you have to look at the problems that cause them and try to minimize those and understand what might be the consequences of imposing that.
My interest, my awareness extends to adolescent slavery and third world countries.
My name is Sarah Stadler-Amon. It's a good question. I don't really know about slavery. Not a whole lot, although I am a seminary student, and so we've talked about the concept of slavery in the Bible, especially in the New Testament, and how Bible, if you look at the words pretty shallowly, does support slavery and doesn't, it condemns it. And so it's an interesting discussion.
My name is Laura Matthews, and I just read Gone with the Wind.
There you go.
And I also, a while back, had a strange interest in prostitution, but I'm just reading about prostitution with a friend of mine. I'm Caitlin Wiggins, and when I think of the word slavery, I just imagine myself way back when, just reading in a history textbook, and it just seemed like a subject that was hard to grasp, and I couldn't imagine it, and I guess, just in my closed box, which I'm trying to open, but yeah, just didn't quite get it.
We're just doing our names, and each person is saying something, and you know, it could be anything on the subject of slavery.
I'm Alex Schmidt, and I live in Leavenworth, Washington. And I've been reading Howard Zinn's book, The People's History of the United States, and learning again that in the early chapters of his book, that slavery has always been a part of our history, and the Declaration of Independence didn't touch it. And when it said free and equal, it meant white men, landed men.
Yeah, in Minneapolis, we have a family of friends with whom we had worked in Papua New Guinea, whose daughter was date raped, and
was led into like prostitution, and who, out of that experience and suffering and pain with her, started the ASTOP organization. I don't know if you've heard of it, but fostering public awareness of how many young white women in the Midwest are, by devious means, led into prostitution.
So really, like, people have a lot of notions and experiences and associations. This ended up being a really valuable exercise the first time that I did this class last weekend. And sort of each time I've done it, more people have different stories to add. So there was, in one of the go-rounds, there was a woman who was raised in North Carolina and got in trouble as a child for drinking from the colored water fountain. There is a woman who is elementary or a middle school teacher in the Midwest, and among her students are Hmong girls from Thailand and Cambodia, and who periodically, like her middle school students, disappear on stints of prostitution. And sometimes the family's really concerned, and sometimes the family is to some degree sort of orchestrating that. Sometimes they come back and sometimes they don't. And so her experience of being their teacher and wanting to look out for them and not being sure how to interact culturally and a whole lot of stuff under that. So a variety of different experiences come out of kind of the wisdom of the group. What I'm going to do is kind of start as an opener reading from the beginning of Kevin Bale's book. And this is a pretty difficult story to hear, so people should be kind of forewarned. This is about a woman called Siba. Yeah, I'll just read it. I was raised by my grandmother in Mali, and when I was still a little girl, a woman that my family knew came and asked my grandmother if she could take me to Paris to care for her children. She told my grandmother that she would put me in school and that I would learn French. When I came to Paris, I was not sent to school. I had to work every day. In their home, I did all the work. I cleaned the house, cooked the meals, cared for the children, washed and fed the baby. Every day I started work before 7 a.m. and I finished about 11 p.m. I never had a day off. My mistress did nothing. She slept late and then she watched television or she went out. One day I told her that I wanted to go to school, but she replied that she had not brought me to France to go to school, but to take care of her children. I was so tired and run down. I had problems with my teeth sometimes and my cheek would swell and the pain would be terrible. Sometimes I had stomach aches. But when I was ill, I still had to work. Sometimes when I was in pain, I would cry, but my mistress would shout at me. I slept on the floor in one of the children's bedrooms. My food was their leftovers. I was not allowed to take food from the refrigerator like the children. If I took food, she would beat me. She often beat me. She would slap me all the time. She beat me with the broom, with the kitchen tools, or whipped me with an electric cable. Sometimes I would bleed. I still have the marks on my body. Once in 1992, I was late going to get the children from school. My mistress and her husband were furious with me. They beat me and then they threw me out onto the street. I had nowhere to go, I didn't understand anything, and I wandered on the streets. After some time, her husband found me and took me back to their house. There they stripped me naked, tied my hands behind my back, and began to whip me with a wire attached to a broomstick. Both of them were beating me at the same time. I was bleeding a lot and screaming, but they continued to beat me. Then she rubbed chili pepper into my wounds and stuck it in my vagina. I lost consciousness. Sometime later, one of the children came and untied me. I lay on the floor where they had left me for several days. The pain was terrible, but no one treated my wounds. When I was able to stand, I had to start to work again, but after this I was always locked in the apartment. They continued to beat me. Siva was finally freed when a neighbor who heard the sounds of her screaming managed to talk to her and call the police and was able to help get her released. If Siva's case were unique, it would be shocking enough. But Siva is perhaps one of 3,000 household slaves in the city of Paris. Nor is such labor unique to the city of Paris. In London, Vancouver, New York, Zurich, Los Angeles, across the world, children are brutalized as household slaves. And they are one small group of the world's slaves. Slavery is not a horror safely consigned to the past. It continues to exist throughout the world, even in developed countries like France and the United States. Across the world, slaves work and sweat and build and suffer. Slaves in Pakistan may have made the shoes you are wearing and the carpet you stand on. Slaves in the Caribbean may have put sugar in your kitchen and toys in the hands of your children. In India, they may have sewn a shirt on your back and polished the ring on your finger. They are paid nothing. Slaves touch your life indirectly as well. They made the bricks for the factory that made your TV. In Brazil, slaves made the charcoal that tempered the steel that made the springs in your car and the blade on your lawnmower. Slaves grew the rice that fed the woman that wove the lovely cloth that you've put up its curtains. Your investment portfolio and your mutual fund pension own stock in companies using slave labor in the developing world. Slaves keep your costs low and returns on your investments high.
So my response is that's a complete fabrication. You take one case of evil, one person that is clearly abused, and you know, ethically, you have a responsibility to suggest how can you prevent that action. There is evil in the world. The Bible says there's evil. We'll always have evil. You take one evil act and you broaden it to thousands of people. We don't know for a fact that there are slaves making our carpets in India. That's nonsense. I don't believe that. There's no evidence in what you read that that's true. And you owe it to us to give us the sources for slaves in India making our carpets that we use, for all these other slaves doing things. I've been around the world. I've seen a lot of the world. I've not seen a lot of slaves. I've seen happy people making carpets in various
countries. Can you let me interject?
Okay. So please provide some sources.
Okay. This book by Kevin Bales is researched through a number of different research organizations. He documents his methods. It's available. It's not available in the bookstore. I'm sorry. He uses a pretty conservative estimate, judging from different sort of worldwide organizations. He says about 27 million people are living in slavery in the world today. Sorry, it's a little bit of an emotional topic and I'm getting a little flustered. His is
and
a pretty conservative
estimate. You owe it to us to tell us what the original sources are. How do you come to that
his
estimate?
His is a pretty conservative estimate.
What is that estimate?
Folks in
what
India,
estimate?
Higher estimates, do you want?
No, what is that? You're saying he is true. You really owe it to us,
sir,
to explain that why.
Sir, I respect your right to your opinions and so forth, but I really think we, as a way of respect, need to listen to the presentation. Then we can draw our own conclusions and make our own judgments, but we certainly need to hear.
Okay. I'm going to take a break and collect myself and let you make a response.
I've been involved in the Dismantling Racism workshops that we've had in the last 2 days. And there are some of us who are white who cannot comprehend or believe that life is difficult for people of color. And a statement that was made actually in the video, The Color of Fear, yesterday, I would make that statement here, made by a person of color to a person of white who was not able to comprehend or believe that it's as bad as it seems. The question that the person of color had to the person of white was this question. What if that is true? What if what she read and the statistics of the organizations who work at that, what if that is true? How would that change your thinking? What would that do to your worldview if that were true? How would that change?
So sort of a really simple example that I'm going to give to talk about some of the documentation and some of the evidence is the government of India acknowledges that the country of India has sort of an institutionalized debt slavery, that people pay off sort of manufactured debts where they're given sort of initial money, and then they spend periods of years, usually years until they die in their early 40s, working off those debts. Families are indebted and generations are indebted in India. And the Indian national government has a variety of programs to eradicate debt slavery in the country of India. So the folks in the country admit that it is a problem and that it exists. And they give various numbers for the number of people who are in slavery in India. And they have a pretty good vested interest in saying, no, there's not any
slavery. How is that different from the United States credit card industry?
Oh, it's very different.
Debt to the credit card. We have huge public debt in this country.
Because debt slaves in India, for a family of five working off their debt, what they earn is not enough to feed them. That's really different from paying a number of people in this country, but not the same. There are people in this country who aren't earning enough to eat. There are millions of people who aren't earning enough to eat in a system that's designed to draw the profit from that in India. I think what I'm going to do is kind of move as the presentation goes. I'm going to give you this copy of my book, because I bought this one here from the bookstore, because I didn't bring my own with me, and so the store is out. I will give you this at the end of the class, and I think until we get to some more group discussion, I'm not going to field any more questions, because we're getting a little sidetracked, and it feels a little disruptive to me. Does that seem okay to you? Okay, thanks. What I want to do next is bearing the story, and you can bear it in mind as if it happened to one person, or as if, you know, we do have on record numbers of thousands of cases of just household slaves where the folks who are enslaving them have been caught. So, you know, if that story is so, if some of the information that I've read to you, bearing that in mind, let's look at some biblical texts on slavery. And folks who didn't grab a Bible when they came in could do that now. Maybe what we'll do is, can I get people who are willing to read aloud to just raise hands? 1, 2, 3, we're gonna need 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 corresponding. So just sort of find your passage and get ready. And other people can sort of follow along or just listen as they choose. The call of the biblical jubilee, which we'll kind of look at a little bit, at the roots of that in the Leviticus text, one of the things that it talks about is proclaiming release to the captives. And debt slavery was the kind of slavery that was operating in the Hebrew society. So there's some parallels to some of the things that we'll be talking about. And I would just sort of invite, as we look at these different things, to notice and pay attention. What are different, what are changing attitudes biblically towards slavery? And you know, there's no such thing as in biblical time. Biblical time spans a number of centuries. So attitudes and practices change over time. And similarly, we don't know whether the Bible is prescriptive or whether it's descriptive. We don't know whether the things that it said in the Bible happened or whether there are things that the folks who gave us these texts would like to happen. We don't know whether, wives obey your husbands was somebody's idea of a good idea or a law that was practiced. So kind of bearing those ways of thinking and asking questions, let's take a look at our heritage scripturally and see what it has to say. And we'll just go around and whoever was born can begin.
From Exodus 1. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Python and Ramses from Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites, and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them.
Exodus 2:23-24. After a long time, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned under their slavery and cried out. Out of the slavery, their cry for help rose up to God. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Exodus 21:2-11. This is from the NIV. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he is to serve you for 6 years. But in the seventh year, he shall go free without paying anything. If he comes alone, he is to go free alone. But if he has a wife when he comes, she is to go with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the woman and her children shall belong to her master, and only the man shall go free. But if the servant declares, I love my master and my wife and children and do not want to go free, then his master must take him before the judges. He shall take him to the door or to the doorpost and pierce his ear with an awl. Then he will be his servant for life. If a man sells his daughter as a servant, she is not to go free as men servants do. If she does not please the master who has selected her for himself, he must let her be redeemed. He has no right to sell her to foreigners because he has broken faith with her. If he selects her for his son, he must grant her the rights of a daughter. If he marries another woman, he must not deprive the first one of her food, clothing, and marital rights. If he does not provide her with these three things, she is to go free without any payment of money.
And from Leviticus 25, if a fellow Israelite living near you becomes so poor that he sells himself to you as a slave, you shall not make him do the work of a slave. He shall stay with you as a hired man and serve you until the next year of restoration. At that time, he and his children shall leave you and return to his family and to the property of his ancestors. The people of Israel are the Lord's slaves, and he brought them out of Egypt. They must not be sold into slavery. Do not treat them harshly, but obey your God. If you need slaves, you may buy them from the nations around you. You may also buy the children of the foreigners who are living among you. Such children born in your land may become your property, and you may leave them as an inheritance to your sons, whom they must serve as long as they live. But you must not treat any of your fellow Israelites harshly.
In the same chapter, if resident aliens among you prosper, and if any of your kin fall into difficulty with one of them and sell themselves to an alien or to a branch of the alien's family, after they have sold themselves, they shall have the right of redemption. One of their brothers may redeem them, or their uncle or their uncle's son may redeem them, or any one of their family who is of their own flesh may redeem them. Or if they prosper, they may redeem themselves. They shall compute with the purchaser the total from the year when they sold themselves to the alien until the Jubilee year. The price of the sale shall be applied to the number of years. The time they were with the owner shall be weighted as the time of a hired laborer. If many years remain, they shall pay for their redemption in proportion to the purchase price. And if few years remain until the Jubilee year, they shall compute thus. According to the years involved, they shall make payment for their redemption. As a laborer hired by the year, they shall be under the alien's authority, who shall not, however, rule with harshness or with them in your sight. And if they have not been redeemed in any of these ways, they and their children with them shall go free in the Jubilee year. For to me, the people of Israel are servants. They are my servants, whom I brought up from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God.
Ephesians. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling in singleness of heart as you obey Christ, not only while being watched and in order to please them, but as slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. Render service with enthusiasm as to the Lord and not to men and women, knowing that whatever good we do, we will receive the same again from the Lord, whether we are slave or free.
So, were there surprises? Were there things that you expected? Sarah said she's been, her sort of comment when we talked about, when we went around and said something about slavery was, well, she's been studying the biblical concept, so I expect you to be up on this. But
it's, what surprised me was, I think it was the Exodus 21 reading, maybe, I think it was, where it talked about, you know, the Israelites should not be your slaves, and I was like, oh, well, that's a different concept, and then said, if you need a slave, go to a different country.
Yeah.
So it's not really an issue of slavery or no slavery, it's an issue of, like, we should not harm our fellow Israelites. So that was surprising to me. But it's not surprising, I guess, given the rest of, in the New Testament, slaves obey your masters, and I mean, the household codes are pretty clear.
Other observations? Were you surprised? Did you expect better? Did you expect worse?
Well, if it says don't enslave your own people, why does it say in Exodus 21, when you buy a male Hebrew slave?
Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, some of that's the issue of debt slavery, and in which is sort of what the biblical jubilee is a work to encounter, is that the idea that even though we have these fantastic law codes with all kinds of detail, that that things are going to get out of hand, and that the rich can only get so much richer according to our rules. And so some of that is, if you went into debt, you could either put your land up, or you could put yourself up, or you could put your children up as collateral, you know, and foreclosure on land and debt slavery were realities. It also seems likely that, you know, you don't have a rule that says, now don't take any Israelite slaves unless somebody was. You know, rules against things generally indicate some level of the practice.
Mm-hmm. But what is the Jubilee?
The Jubilee is, the foundational kind of Jubilee story is encoded in the Leviticus, which the two folks here read. It's a periodic kind of release. You know how in the week there's the Sabbath? Every 7 years as well, there was to be a Sabbath year. And the land was to lie fallow. That's where the sort of the 7 year fallow comes out of that. That certain debts were to be released, that slaves were to go free, and then every 7 times 7 years, every 49th year or 50th, we're not really sure, there's this law that every 50th year was a big jubilee, a big leveling, a
a time when the land rested, when people rested, when animals rested, a time when debts were canceled, a time when land was returned to, like, any land that was foreclosed on was returned to the original owners. I think those are all the elements. The release of captives, redistribution of wealth through land, and through debt cancellation. And yeah, and then that idea was expanded on, this is sort of a law of tribal Israel that was expanded upon by the prophets, who made it somewhat more expansive. And so the one of the Isaiah passages talks about release to all the captives, and it was sort of more joyous in the prophetic interpretation. And that in the early church and in the Jesus movement, it was further expanded to be a movement that was about, largely because people didn't have land anymore, that was about meal sharing and God's abundance that way, and also about health and bodies. So that's the short version of what is the Jubilee.
How is the 7 year different than the 50 year?
I forget exactly. I think the land return only happens in the 50 year, and the 50 year is, I think, and there's some magic stuff in here. The 50 year, none of the land is planted. So unlike a fallow where you kind of rotate the fields and rest them, there's a little bit of magic in some of the prescriptions. And so they expected that you would gather food, but you wouldn't grow crops. And some of that is that if you're saving food, then you'll have saved food. So some of it's, you remember the story about the manna? And how manna came. Manna is a very Sabbath economics and Jubilee kind of story, that there was bread or something to eat enough for every day, but if you hoarded it, it went bad. If you tried to save it till the next day, it rotted and stank and gave you away. And that similarly, on the sort of the eve of the seventh day, there was a double measure. So there's some of that, there'll be a double measure, but it's the land return, I think, that is the big difference. And what we have is a couple of different versions of similar laws, and so there's overlap. And I could point you to an article that kind of picks apart what the difference between the seventh year and the 50th year is.
Has this ever happened in any society that we know of?
Certainly people practice a weekly Sabbath. There are...
I mean about land, giving back land, forgiving of debts, these things.
I'm getting there. There are some folks in North Africa who practice a land return, or a land sort of redistribution on a seven-year cycle. And we don't know whether that came before the Bible or if it came after. So we don't know who's the root of who there. It seems like at least sometimes there are records of kind of renewal movements biblically where people came back from, I can't remember, one of the exiles and said, we need to have the year of Jubilee. So it seems like it was something that sometimes needed to be pushed for. It's not a thing that there's going to be hard archaeological evidence for. You know, you can't dig up the Jubilee. And so we need to evaluate it in on other terms.
Is it practiced in Israel today?
Pardon me?
Is it practiced in Israel today?
No.
Is it practiced in any Christian country?
Certainly in the at the turn of the millennium, Christian churches worked together on a debt relief campaign called Jubilee 2000, and they kind of capitalized on the fact that we were coming up with a number that was clearly divisible by 50, and said, okay, the situation of international debt is such that while for every dollar that goes to the third world in foreign aid, $3 comes out paying the interest on debts that have already been paid off. So that that for-profit institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which are largely centered in the West, are kind of reaping profit from countries that they are saying that they're providing for. And so what if we were to cancel the debts of, say, the 50 poorest nations or the 10 most indebted nations? And there were campaigns around this, and they had some level of success at the G8 summit, which was, I believe, in 2000. Tens of thousands of people, perhaps, no, I'm underestimating, hundreds of thousands of people attended demonstrations worldwide, really putting pressure for that to happen. There was some level of debt relief, and people are still working on those issues. Jubilee 2000 is a continuing organization.
I think there have been a number of cases of that, of the World Bank or countries forgiving the debt of poorer countries over the last 10 years, I know, a number of cases.
And churches had a significant
probably,
leadership
yeah,
in that.
Well, and isn't the Millennium Project that we heard about at Neil, we're going to write letters for tomorrow, kind of a follow-up to the...
I believe so, and I'm less sort of, know less about that. If you wanted to say more about it.
I don't know too much more than what I heard at lunch, and the fact that a friend of mine that works at Bread for the World is involved in that Millennium Project, and he's kind of Bread's, or one of Bread's representatives, to kind of help push that along. So I don't know too much, but I think it is tied in with that. And then I was also thinking yesterday we learned about some historical movements.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That used the Jubilee kind of idea and went back to the Jubilee roots in England, and I believe it was the 15 or 1600s, and then also some of the Underground Railroad stuff. So.
Oh, sorry, I thought
no,
that was
no,
a,
no. Just,
a pen wave there.
I'm just eager to hear what else you have to share with us.
Okay. Maybe if anybody has a last comment who hasn't had a chance to speak on the biblical stuff.
It struck me how the women were still didn't get the same treatment as the male slaves, and they could stay in slavery, whereas the males was expected that they would get the freedom after a certain time.
It was also interesting to note, I'm not sure whoever read the Exodus passage on slavery, but that there's no distinction made. It says if a man is enslaved for a period of time and you give him a wife, if at the end of his period of slavery he can choose to go free or he can choose to stay with her, mm-hmm. which they call declaring that you love your master,
yeah.
not declaring that you love your partner or your children. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of creepy stuff mm-hmm. going on in there, stuff about gender, stuff about...
Mm-hmm. I know I talked before, but I think it's interesting with that comment about women is that I never, until just now, realized that for women, prostitution often went with slavery, or that the slavery was something that was sexual exploitation and not just physical exploitation. And it's striking to me that that is okay and in the biblical witness.
On that note, let's move and talk about the example of Thailand, which is pretty notorious. Another book that I want to recommend to folks is called Casting Stones. And I'm going to look in my book to find out, which is also available in the bookstore. Just going to look in my book and find the reference for that, because I can't remember the author's name. But it's on prostitution in Asia and in the United States.
Susan Thistlethwaite.
Yes, and it was not Susan Thistlethwaite and Rita Nakashima Brock. Perhaps somebody would volunteer to be a scribe and could write that information up on the board. There we go. You can read it right off there if you want. Or not.
Oh, yeah.
I've got it sort of marked in the
book there if you want.
So the the case of Thailand is very, very well documented. Thailand has an extremely high population of prostitutes. Prostitution is really ingrained in Thai culture. It's a very macho culture. It's a culture where if you're a business person, part of sealing any business deal, and if you're a business person, that means you're a business man for just about everybody, means that you would provide prostitutes for your clients. That if you were a college student and you were doing part of your initial weeks of tours of your school, and tours of brothels would be included in that. So it's extremely ingrained in the culture. There's a very high proportion of the population are prostitutes. Of the million to million and a half prostitutes in Thailand, about 35,000 of those are people who are young women who are sold knowingly, like knowingly by them and by their families, with the promise that they will earn money for their families, and with the reality that they have extremely short kind of working lifespans, extremely high levels of disease, mental illness, like sort of mental breakdown, and physical abuse and death from violence. Mostly the poor girls and women who are slaves in brothels serve Thai men. There's a small export business for the sex tourist economy, and that's based largely in Japan, and then there's sort of export to various military bases as well around the world. And the global economy has really abused a situation that was already awful in Thailand and really taken advantage of the fact that Thais were already enslaving one another, and that that poor girls are extremely vulnerable in that culture. Usually the price of a colored television is the price of a girl. Business owners are mostly middle-class men. Being a smart business person is a value in the culture. That people probably own a variety of businesses, but being a brothel owner is in no way shameful. There was, when we did the go-around telling stories 2 times ago, there was a man in the group who was a Rotary Club member, and which is a service organization. Folks are kind of familiar with Rotary Club. They give scholarships to students, and they promote friendship between businessmen. And when a friend of his in his same Rotary Club, they were doing some of the first exchanges with Thai students and American students, and this man's daughter was selected for the Rotary exchange. And there's the way Rotary works is that if you're the child up, then you sort of have more points towards that. So she was selected to go to the Rotary exchange. Turns out that the businessman who was the host family was a brothel owner. That a fancy car was sent to pick her up at the airport, and that the man's family and wife were absent from the house, and the brothel owner was there, and that she was sexually assaulted. She was able to contact her father, and he like got on a plane and got there and got her out of the situation, but was able to make no headway, no repercussions, no consequences of any kind for this man, who was a fine, upstanding Rotary Club member, who was, and that's just kind of out of a room of 15 people that somebody had that experience was quite remarkable. And so it's very ingrained in the culture. Young women who are, and they're physically combined, they're confined to compounds. Their sort of initiation into sex trade almost invariably involves rape. You know, they're held down. They bring a specially high price if they're especially young. On the average, they're servicing like 15 to 20 men a night, mostly poor Thai men,
And as I think I said before, they have a kind of a work span of, you know, a year to about 8 years. Frequently in large Thai cities, you know, in the rivers and in the gutters in the morning, there are people who pick up the bodies of sex workers. And that's workers who are enslaved and workers who are in, you know, less savory, sort of voluntary sex work in the country of Thailand. So that's one example.
I have a question. Sure. So, so in Thailand, for example, then there are voluntary, well, as voluntary.
There are non-enslaved.
Non-enslaved prostitutes.
The majority of prostitutes.
And then, so the brothels, the profit from the prostitution would go directly to the brothel owner. And
there's a breakdown in Kevin Vale's book that shows sort of, one of the research tools that he used was posing as a businessman and talking to various businessmen and saying, you know, if a person wanted to get into your kind of business, what's your return? How does that work? What do you pay for rent? You know, what do you pay for this? And people were pretty forthcoming. They were like, you know, it's regrettable when we have to go and like hunt down a girl. But she has this debt, you know, that she needs to pay to her family. It's regrettable. But people were pretty forthcoming with the situations that they were in, that the way that they used. And one thing in Thailand is that often the police will return young women who escape.
Well, I can confirm the situation in Thailand, because I've been in it. It's exactly like you said. Prostitution is legal. There are brothels everywhere. And they are, men go to them, and I think women go to them too. There's nothing against the law. It's quite different from in our country. Men come, the Japanese love to go to Thailand because the women are cheap. The only thing I agree with, I don't think they charge the cost of a television set. It's a whole lot less than the cost of a television set.
No, that's to buy the girl from.
Oh, to buy, oh, I see, oh, right.
That's so the business owner owns her for the rest of her life.
And, you know, there is a lot of disease, and I think the Thai government is concerned with that. They're trying to stop the disease thing.
Mm-hmm. And there's, in Thailand, but there's also, that's part of their, sex tourism is part of their official money-making policy. So they really, you know, compromise a significant proportion of their citizens.
The Thai who participate in this, are they Christian or Muslim?
I don't know.
Because the country is pretty, I think, split.
No, there's not a lot of Muslims in Thailand. It's basically a Buddhist country.
So they're Buddhist.
Yeah, but I would not guess that.
I thought there was a Muslim. Maybe I'm
there may be
Bali.
A small amount. Yeah, Bali. Bali actually is Hindu, and the rest of Indonesia is Muslim. But it's Buddhist.
So I think one of the things that's worth talking about is how can we eliminate that?
I want to listen to another person, and I do think that's worth talking about.
Just occurs to me how, in many respects, it's similar here in the States as far as, you know, Nevada legalized prostitution and the internet. You know, magazines of all kinds, how sex sells, everything from automobiles to refrigerators, and just how much of our economy is in some respects fueled by the sex trade. Maybe not a whole lot different from Cambodia in some respects.
Proportionally, I think it's a significantly different amount of the economy.
Yeah.
And I think that people have a broader range of economic choices. I think what I'm going to do, because we've used up an awful lot of time, we're close to the end. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you an example of another country where a fairly different kind of slavery is practiced. And then what I'm going to do is talk about a little bit about how slavery today is different from slavery in the antebellum South. You know, this is how the new slavery is different from the kind of the transatlantic slave trade, where people were brought from Africa to the Americas. So we're going to talk about Mauritania
It's a country in Northwest Africa. It's a very small country. The population is a percent of white Arabs, about 30%. They generally claim they're about 40% of the population. About 40% black African population, and whatever the remaining percent is, sort of however you work that out, of folks who at some point in history have relatives from both sides, ancestors from both sides. And the white Arabs are sort of organized into families and into clans. Sort of the mixed race population is very much a, kind of a middle group, sometimes small merchants. There's not a lot of work that's considered honorable for the slave-holding population, the upper 30%. The other 40% do all of the work in the country. They call themselves slaves, they identify as slaves, they are called slaves and identified as slaves by their masters. It's an old, old kind of slavery. It's a situation where people are associated by families over years and years and years. So the father of the slave and the father of the master were slave and master. Masters are really crummy word, but that's the terminology that they use. The father of the slave owner and the father of the enslaved person. Similarly, mother and mother were for generations going back. And so slavery is enforced with much less violence than in some of the other situations, but it's much, much more ingrained. It's a country that's really, really hard to visit. And so Kevin Bales, when he did his research there, went as a naturalist and was that people are extremely friendly and open once you're there, but because of this sort of secret of slavery that's existed in this country for so long, slavery has been abolished in Mauritania a number of times through history, most recently in the 1980s. So in the 1980s, the country itself, the government of the country said, no more slavery. The slavery that we've had up until now, we're going to stop having. However, they didn't tell the 40 to 50% of the population who continues to live as slaves, who continue to be subject to householders. So that's a third and a different kind of slavery. The difference between kind of the old slavery and the new slavery, the slavery that's practiced now under global capitalism, usually legal ownership is avoided now. Used to be a high purchase cost. There are like records in the United States, in slavery museums and historical documents that record, $900 for a male slave. So the purchase cost was high. You could get a lot of slaves now for that $900. Now, purchase cost is very low. Then the profit margin was pretty low. Now the profit margin is extremely high. The breakdown for what like brothel owners are making is extremely, extremely high. There was a shortage of potential slaves. Like the situation in Thailand now, there's a surplus of potential slaves driving the value of human beings down. It was a long-term relationship. Mauritania is one of the few existing situations where race is a factor. That's, I think, the next thing. Ethnic differences used to be important. They're not important now. Thais are enslaving Thais. There's some regional differences, but very little. Mostly it's differences in economics and access to stuff. Used to be a long-term relationship. Now it's a short-term relationship, a very high turnover. You can use people for a period of years, and when their useful work life is up, then you don't need to see to them in their old age. I trust this research. Organization called Anti-Slavery International is another organization that's doing research and work. They give significantly higher estimations than the figures that I've talked about for numbers of people enslaved. There's a group in the United States called Free the Slaves. It was started by African Americans. Some folks who found out about international slavery and were really sort of compelled to work on that issue. Those are some good organizations. There's an organization called Rugmark that works specifically on the issue of child work, child labor and child slavery in the rug trade in India. And they have worked really hard at getting sort of an incorruptible group of investigators to do their investigating. So Rugmark International is another organization to look to. I think there's some information about them on the kiosk. And I, you know, I think it's really good to check your sources and to find out and to look around for information. So, yes.
I've been trying to remember the name of the book, and I'm sorry I can't, but a book I recently read talks about all the slavery in Sudan that has gone on to this young man who told of there it tended to be a Muslim Christian thing because of the situation in the country, but how he was taken for years and had a terrible time to escape, and I mean true slavery, and that's a first-hand personal account thing. He spoke for, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And I'm really sorry I can't recall the name, but it's quite a compelling first-hand account.
One of the sort of investigative techniques that is sort of a good example to follow is the environmental movement has an investigating organization. When they started to realize kind of the ways that people were doing corporations were doing massive scale pollution and not having any accountability for that, you know, that they were polluters and they were writing, the pollution legislation, that people started investigating. People who were good at doing, covert photography, people who were good at going in and saying, you know, I'm a business person and I'm researching this and how can we learn more about how to make more profits? And, so to have some really good researchers is a direction to move in. To ask, you know, when you're working with aid organizations, what do you know about the situation of slaves in the country where you're working, and what are you doing about that? Slave labor I think the Dominican Republic, when a law in the United States about buying sugar from countries that practice slave labor, a significant proportion of the labor and slave state that was going on there was turned around because of legislation from a major exporter, or a major importer rather, on a major export. So there are issues to work on and ways to work on stuff. So I'm gonna close now. I'm gonna give you my book.
Thank you.
And thank everybody for coming out.
Thank you. Thank you.